to the Tell It Like It Is podcast, where leading female founders, industry trailblazers, and all-around badass women tell it like it really is. I'm your host, Cassandra Ray.
Today's guest is a social entrepreneur with a truly incredible story. In 2004, when she was just 24, she survived the Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami that claimed over 200,000 lives. This prompted the beginning of a significant career shift away from the high-powered and well-paid career in advertising and media that she had always dreamt of. At 34, she co-founded Social Starters with a mission to plug the skills gap in social enterprise in the UK and around the world. As CEO of Social Starters, she has supported almost 450 social entrepreneurs and enterprises across six countries. She was voted one of 2019's top 100 women in social enterprise and won the WISE 100 Award for Women's Champion. Andrea, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, can I just say thank you for that amazing introduction? It's so surreal hearing yourself being described by another human being, A, and then B, being in the same room as them at the same time, which is why I jumped on coming into the studio with you today. Because, yeah, 3 months living in isolation, alone, in my apartment in Southeast London. It's been an interesting time, hasn't it?
Yeah. How have you, I mean, I know as CEO leading an organization, you know, dedicated to making the impact, how have you adapted your business, your leadership in this time?
We were very lucky when the crisis hit that we were already a remote organization. So we have always been a remote organization. We've dipped into working in co-working spaces and other partner offices throughout the years. But fundamentally, we're all based around the world in different countries, and we're used to working in that remote way. So there wasn't a huge shift for us on that front, but we were just preparing to deliver this really exciting program called the Immersion Program. And it was the first time we were going to do it in a room, in a classroom, face to face here in London. And people were planning to fly in from all around the world. So that was tricky, but we just very quickly took our curriculum online, redesigned the structure of the program, and actually our pending visitors, our participants in the program, were relieved when we said that we were going to approach it that way, because at that time, the flights were still going and we weren't in complete lockdown, right? Mm. So they were a bit nervous and hesitant about coming to the UK. And so this actually just freed up their sense of concern and eliminated those concerns, and also then allowed other people to join the program who otherwise hadn't booked on yet. And when the lockdown happened and the crisis hit, we were inundated with people wanting to participate in our program, perhaps because they suddenly had lots of time on their hands and they wanted to keep busy and be part of a group of collective individuals working towards some common goal that had meaning and purpose. And so it worked out quite well, and we were really busy the last 3 months.
Mm. So actually, I think that's a great segue before we get into your personal story and how you actually made this career transition. Can you tell us a little bit about the Social Starters program, how it works, what you do?
Of course, yes. Social Starters is an organization that aims to do two things. One is around creating a platform for career-oriented professionals to develop their skills, learn new things, discover what it takes to create impact, positive social and environmental impact within a business environment. And we do that in a number of different ways. And along the way, we also work with individuals to develop their careers outside of their existing, you know, employee-employer relationship. With that, we've seen many individuals go on to work in the social impact space, combining social impact with business, and that's what we call the social enterprise sector. But then equally, we also are on a mission to plug skills gaps, as you said in the introduction, within social enterprises. And so these are our much-loved hundreds of thousands of social enterprises here in the UK. There are many more around the world as well. And those skills gaps are really, really important, because if they're not plugged, they could be the difference between a social enterprise being successful or having to, you know, become one of the statistics of 99% of startups fail in their first year, right? So, we plug those skill gaps by finding talent. It's all about redistributing talent and educating the next generation of social leaders and training people to explore what it means to be a social leader, build their confidence, and explore their what next in their careers.
Mm. So I know in my own life, I've met several people that have come from, say, strategy consulting or banking or lots of kind of what we'd consider high-powered, high-talent careers that have wanted to transition to social impact and have obviously great skills and a great motivation at some point in their lives to have a greater impact and have a really hard time getting their foot in the door, getting any social enterprise or nonprofit to take them seriously, to even interview for a role. Why do you think it is that there seems to be this silo between the nonprofit and the for-profit sector, or even social impact that is for-profit?
It is really difficult. And I myself recall a time in my late 20s when I was writing to charities and applying for roles and telling them about all of my experiences working in national media. And they'd return to me when I was lucky that they would come back to me and they'd say, you've got amazing experience, but you haven't worked in the third sector. And we're looking for people who have demonstrable experience working in the charity space or with NGOs in development, if you're interested in the development piece. And so it's a bit of a catch-22 in that you've got to work in the sector, but to work in the sector, you've got to have prior experience. And so you end up with this well of people all working for free at some point in their lives, usually earlier on in their careers. And those types of people are obviously the ones that are in a position to be able to do it, often the more privileged. And so it's notoriously difficult to get into the space of doing good, which is where I think social entrepreneurship becomes really exciting, because for me it was a bridge to create my own job and to create my own career. It marries business with purpose. And so if you have the business skills, then to me, this was where I saw a solution to a major problem, because those business skills are needed for social entrepreneurship to thrive. Often lots of people who are in the third sector go off to start a social enterprise. And what's great about that is that they know how to make impact. They understand about monitoring and evaluating that impact. And they understand about safeguarding all the things that are really important when you work with vulnerable groups. But perhaps that person doesn't have 10 years of experience growing a business, or maybe they don't have an MBA or whatever it is that is deemed the thing that's going to create a sustainable, thriving, business-focused organization. So for business professionals, there's a really exciting opportunity there to come together with those impact makers and share those skills, whether it's in a leadership function or as a volunteer.
I know that your evolution going from a career in advertising and media all the way to, you know, social impact work took a while and didn't happen overnight. You want to tell us a little bit about your journey from one place to the next?
Yeah, sure. I always say it took me 12 years to develop my career, and therefore I created a business around shortcutting that for people, because it was 12 long, painful, colourful, don't get me wrong, lots of learnings and lots of great things happened along the way, but 12 long years. And, you know, it doesn't need to take that long to find purpose, to have meaning, to feel fulfilled. So for me, I think the most groundbreaking discovery was that I can volunteer, that I can share my skills, or even just my time, if these were not skills-based opportunities. And when I was 28, I went to prison and I volunteered for a charity who had a through-the-gate program. So what that means is that you are there to support offenders as they come out of prison into and reintegrate back into the real world. And that might be that you support them through just becoming their friend, writing letters to them, going and visiting them, building that relationship. And then when they come out, you might be there to meet them with a mobile phone, you know, buy them some food and help take them to their next place, wherever that might be. Mm. And then that relationship can develop. And it's been proven that those relationships, because they're so neutral to their friendship groups or their family circles, that it can prove to have a positive effect on rehabilitation and reduce reoffending rates. That was a big thing for me to do. It was super out of my comfort zone, and it meant a lot to me, and I did it for 2 years. And I think that just then opened the next door. And so I always say that volunteering, getting out your comfort zone, doing something completely different, learning about a particular area that you're passionate about, or that you're intrigued about, or something that feels unjust or frustrates you and you want to contribute towards making it better somehow, whatever that thing is, can then take you on the next step to the next thing. Because within that, you unlock a Pandora's box of stuff that prior to that you have no idea even exists, right? And it's unlocking those boxes at each level as you go deeper into your own self-awareness and discovery. Then, yeah, you find new avenues and new paths and build confidences that weren't there before.
I feel like when people talk to me about getting stuck in their careers or even their lives, you know, you get to that place where you're just, what's the next plateau? Or, you know, you're just feeling a bit about where you are at the moment. One of the best things you can do is find a way to be of service somehow. Just somehow getting out of your own head and your own, how can things be of service to me, but thinking about how I can be of service to others can just be that ignition you need to get to somewhere else. You know, like you said, unlocking the Pandora's box. I'm super interested at the moment about understanding more about how we can support prison populations. I mean, we're recording this in London at the moment, but I grew up in America, mostly in California, spent some time also in Florida and New York, and have been really affected by, you know, films like The 13th. I don't know if you've seen. And just trying to learn more about racism, obviously in light of the Black Lives Matter movement, and structural racism in particular. And we look at, you know, in America, just how disproportionate are, you know, statistics are about how many people of color are in our jails and prisons. And these this really warped, it seems to me from the outside as a layman, bail system we have in America. So I'm really interested in that work. I don't know much about it, but I'd be very interested in learning more. Where do you recommend someone start?
I think no matter the cause, no matter the thing that's fired you up, and there's a lot going on this year from public health through to this institutionalized racism that we're talking about at the moment, that I think is going to do so much to raising a new generation of cause, you know, impassioned people to stand up and do something. It's actually really, really exciting. And so whatever that cause is, you know, it's up to you to go and educate yourself. Now, that can be simple desk research, reading inspiring books, watching a film that really connects with you, and then that leads to the next thing. But ultimately, you know, finding the community groups who also share that passion for that cause, whether they're on Facebook or wherever they live or housed, it might be in your immediate direct community, there might be meetings taking place. Just going to those meetings and connecting with those groups, even though it might feel terrifying, just do it and go and see what happens and see how you feel and see who you meet. And just take that one step. Don't think beyond that, because you'll possibly overthink it and maybe then you won't do it and it'll take years until you finally get around to it. Just take it one tiny baby step at a time.
Yeah, the best way to get started is to get started, right?
Yes. Yeah. it's harder than it sounds.
So I have read that about a third of your participants on the Social Starters Consulting Program are women. Is that right?
Yeah, two-thirds.
Two-thirds. I meant 70%.
Yeah. We do have a rather large number of women who constantly apply for and join our programs, which is fantastic. It's so great. And I love women's energy, particularly in this space. Women are doers. And they're also very contemplative, and they think and they reflect and they want to better themselves. And I'm not saying men don't at all, but this is what I see amongst these amazing women that come on our programs. But then we also attract these phenomenal men as well. And we recently launched a scholarship specifically to try and find the next social impact male leader, because male leaders within the social impact space need nurturing and development too. And if we switch the focus constantly all about women, then we'll end up with the opposite problem, right? It's actually like we've got this weird phenomenon where there's lots of women in this space. Social entrepreneurship, social enterprise in the UK has the largest number of female leaders than any other sector in the UK, which is really great. It's really forward thinking. There's still so much more work to do, to be honest. I'm not saying like we've reached the pinnacle and like we can sit back and be like, ta-da, we've made it. Women now rule the world. And it's definitely not the case. But it's something that I'm very proud of. But I want more men to come on my programs, because it doesn't matter whether you're a woman or a man, you know? I think everybody has a different energy and something to bring to the experience, right?
Do you think, I mean, do you have a hypothesis as to why more women are attracted to this field or more women go into this field than men?
I think there's the obvious answers, right? And then there's probably a few outliers around it. And, you know, women are, you know, by their nature, you know, more caring, and they're the caregivers, and they like to nurture and to support projects that make a difference. But I almost feel a bit loath and a bit reticent to keep pumping this rhetoric because, I don't know, I don't like differentiating men and women in this black and white way.
It feels a bit uncomfy,
archaic.
Right? Yeah, or like it just feels a bit, well, not every woman wants to nurture and not every woman wants to be a mother.
Well, absolutely, yeah. So I don't like it. But that's the answer people often expect me to say and it's the one that's being touted around. But there's a lot more complicated reasons than that, I think. Yeah.
Do
you want me to dive in?
Yeah, dive in. Because I think I do suspect as well. I mean, I'm not an expert on social enterprise, but if we look, for example, one of my hypotheses would be, and I would love to be proven wrong, and I'm again speaking as a layman, but pretty much any field that is underpaid, there are more women in. And we're going to come on to this later, but social impact work does tend to be underpaid. And so I wonder if there's some kind of something there to unpack, actually.
We're still battling age-old human and societal conditions that say the man has to go out and be the breadwinner and to go and make loads of money. And in doing that, they might have to make lots of decisions and knock things out the way to climb to the top, right? Which is this, you know, alpha male ideal. And those tend to be, in a lot of cases, the kinds of people that follow those milestones. And, you know, they go out and they find their partner and then they buy their house and then they, you know, they then have the kids and they're reaching those milestones and powering through them. Women, on the other hand, are in a position sometimes where they are able to take a career break, or maybe they have children, right? And so they spend a lot of their, what would otherwise be their career time, bringing up the family. And then in around that, then they need to feel that value again. And so they go back and take on part-time jobs while they're, you know, balancing the family dynamics. And this is very, you know, stereotypical, obviously, and not indicative of the modern relationship or family dynamic by any stretch. But within that, I think there's perhaps less room for males, broadly speaking, to take those breaks, take those timeouts, take a step back, not necessarily be bringing in their income. And perhaps women have a bit more flexibility. And in amongst that flexibility, those lesser paid roles come along that are with startups or small charities or small social enterprises. And actually, you know, it really means something to that person. And this could be a man or a woman, let's just speak more broadly, at any time in their lives, and you know, and they want to do something because they're more passionate about it. And when you've spent 15, 20 years bulldozing through your career, making money for already very wealthy people, there just comes a point, I think, man or woman, where you say, you know what, there's more to life, right?
Absolutely. I mean, he's not the only one to say this, but Tim Ferriss, I think, is a fan of saying that time is your most valuable non-renewable resource. And that has really stuck with me since I read it or heard him say it. I can't remember how many years ago, a decade or so ago. And I repeat that to myself a lot. If I ever find myself working for a client or doing some work that I think is, if I can't see the longer term impact or meaning in it, I mean, it doesn't need to be a social enterprise, but if I can't see the, you know, several, you know, movements down the value chain, whose life is better because I'm doing this thing, if I can't somehow connect my work to that,
right,
I'm super demotivated.
Right.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people will echo that sentiment. Now, you need the cogs in the wheels. You need the people that don't challenge that, because businesses are machines at the end of the day, and humans do fit in, and that's noble work. And thank God we have millions of people that are doing that and not doing it in a way where they're challenging it constantly, because I fear for what would happen if all of a sudden we went, I'm just going to quit my job and, you know, go around in a combi van for the next year.
Okay. So you have said, I believe, that you're going to make 2020 the year you change the way you live and consume for the sake of the planet. How's
You've
that
read
going?
My LinkedIn profile.
I do my research, Andrea. I do my research. So how's that going?
It's been thwarted a little bit by COVID-19. But I'm still endeavouring. It's amazing, isn't it, how much headspace we have for things. I think it's a limited amount of headspace, isn't it, that we actually have to take on projects and to think about what we do ethically. But I have created a system where I don't buy anything new anymore. And if I want to acquire new things, I buy them secondhand. And in order to acquire them, I then have to lose something. So that's been quite interesting. And I've been able to do that throughout the crisis, locally through, one of those local secondhand providers.
Means you don't buy anything new. You mean clothes?
Clothes, furniture, anything to do with DIY. I mean, I bought some paint brand new, but when I got the tester pots, I bought them all secondhand because somebody had caught my eye saying 50 Shades of Grey on Gumtree. And I was like, oh yeah, what's this? And,
In lockdown.
It didn't take a lot, yeah. Then I was like, oh, loads of paint tester pots. That's cool. And then I get to go and, walk 10 minutes around the corner, engage with a human being, albeit socially distanced, and, save a bit of money, reuse something that's just going to waste. And that was like a cute little thing that I was doing as I decided to tidy up my apartment and make use of all of this fantastic time that I've gained, because throughout this crisis, we've all learned how distracting we've been to ourselves, haven't we? Like how going out and socialising and going in, going out and experiencing the world, which are all amazing things, but we're so overwhelmed by amazing things to go and do. Arts, culture, like London is the best city in the world and everything is here. Every possible culture, you name it, every food, every cultural delight. And it's so easy for years just to go by, just going out and doing things and experiencing things. And so when you have that stripped back, hasn't it been fascinating how we've seen birds that we've never known existed on our doorstep? And we can hear those birds as well, right? And we've all reconnected with nature. And I think now everyone's just fantasizing about going camping, aren't they, from July the 4th. And it's brilliant. So changing the way I live and work, that's ultimately boiling down to being more ecological in my approach, like connecting with nature, finding joy in the simplest of things, and consuming less. And I know that's not good news for the economy. And I am a capitalist to a certain extent, and I believe that we do need to spend money, otherwise, I dread to think what's going to happen. But at the same time, I'm making these choices now. And I was a huge consumer. And I dread to think how much I've racked up on credit cards over the years, just buying things because it felt nice or because I wanted to look good and spending money on stuff. And when I was in my early to mid-30s, I'm going to loop back in Tim Ferriss now because I really wanted to say something about that at the time. He was answering one of your big questions earlier about influences. He was one of the biggest influences for me because somebody said to me at a party, oh, you should read Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. I'd never heard of him and I'd never heard of the book. And when I read it, speaking about time, this simple concept of taking early retirements throughout your life and not waiting for the one big retirement when you're 60 or 70 years old, right? Like, you might be dead by then. So what's the point in waiting till then to go off and finally tour the world in a combi van or whatever it might be that you really want to do? This concept of taking these mini retirements or career breaks or sabbaticals or whatever you want to call them is so important, isn't it? And I think we've all just been given a mini retirement for the last 3 months. And we've 100%. All discovered things, we've rested. It's been horrible as well, right? And I don't want to say this and negate any of the, the pain and the sadness and the awful things that have been going on, of course. But it is just interesting to think about, isn't it?
It is. What role did you have immediately before co-founding Social Starters?
I went to Kenya to volunteer, and prior to that, I'd been working in marketing, helping youth organisations to better connect with youth audiences. And I'd done a lot working with, you know, social media influencers. I won't name any names. And it was a very interesting time, but I really felt like it was time to get back to that international development piece. And I started my journey out in my early 20s going travelling and spent a lot of time in Africa and Southeast Asia, where a whole bunch of very important things happened. And I needed to get a bit of closure on that. I needed to go back, and it was really hard to work in international development. I didn't have that master's in international development. So this was me in DIY career mode. So the specific role was as a program manager for a social enterprise who supported micro-entrepreneurs in Western Kenya to be able to better grow their very small businesses. And you know, I say business is a term very loosely because this is an informal economy. So this might well be the shoe shiner on the street or the person that makes popcorn or sells coal on the side of the road. Mm. A variety of different types of business, very important. They are, you know, like livelihood, income streams and support families and many people in that part of the world. That is how they make their money. But could they be doing it more creatively, you know, applying more innovative techniques? And these were the questions that we were trying to answer. And it was while I was volunteering doing that, that I just met these amazing entrepreneurs who were not just selling coal on the side of the road, but either had aspirations to do something more impactful in their communities to better the lives of the people in those communities, or they were already doing it. And so they were working to tackle the issues of street children, bringing them in and training them to become carpenters so that they could earn incomes. And at the same time, then you go and sell that furniture and they could make money. And I'd been working in a social enterprise prior to that. And so I recognised that that was socially entrepreneurial and felt just a really strong tethering to that, to be able to support them in whatever way that I could. And so that then organically led to the creation of Social Starters, which was really just a simple concept. And that was, how can I scale me up? And it was the best thing one of my Airbnb guests ever said to me, actually, where he just actually said, Andrea, you're not that special. No offense. You're not that special. There's thousands, hundreds of thousands of yous around the world. You know, you can sell things, you do business development, you know, you can package things up and make them look pretty. And I was like, yeah, God, you're right. I'm not that special at all. There's loads of me's. So let's just go and find more people like that who have these amazing business skills, who are at that crossroads, who want to make a difference, maybe take a bit of time out, and let's put them to work.
So it's interesting. I mean, notwithstanding that you've just minimized you and what you do just a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about how you've gone from the CEO of an organization helping other people to do that work. What was that process like for you, becoming, you know, CEO, leader of an organization of other people?
If anyone understands imposter syndrome, it's me. I wasn't the CEO to begin with at all. In fact, I was probably a consultant on what was a project, a very fledgling project, and then became a co-founder in the development of that project, which, you know, morphed and shifted as time went by. I think I was probably the commercial, you know, the head of commercial director in the early days, which was more my comfort zone. I'm not quite sure how much my role has changed since then, though, apart from I have a fancier job title now. But I've changed. And my leadership muscle has definitely been flexed. All I can say is, when I first started, I couldn't even call myself an entrepreneur. That just felt like I was lying. I didn't feel very comfortable with it. I think it's a mindset you adopt over time when you've perhaps behaved in the ways that entrepreneurs behave, which is taking certain amounts of risks, mitigated risks, throwing yourselves out there into the fire, having to do the hard judgment calls, have the challenging conversations, fail, and then come back. Mm. And I think we've failed and come back a number of times, and then I think you earn your right to comfortably call yourself an entrepreneur. But if anybody's feeling that way right now and they're a year or two into running their business, then, I just want to tell them that that's very normal to feel strange about it. It is a total journey. Mm. But you get used to it. I mean, you have to fake it till you make it a little bit. And that almost, I don't want to give bad advice here, but it's almost a bit like you have to fake it within your own head, because what you're probably battling for a lot of people anyway is a slight challenge on your self-belief, right? And what you're capable of, because you don't really know what you're capable of until you do it, do you?
Mm.
But that's what leadership is. Not to bring it back to our programs, but that's what we do on our programs, is that we give that platform to professionals to make those judgment calls, to be put a little bit into the fire, to get outside that comfort zone, to test themselves and do the scary stuff, but then come back fighting. Even if you necessarily don't respond or behave in a way that you think was the right way, there's got to be a space for making those fuck ups, right? Mm. Like, we can't always be perfect. And I've definitely made my fuck ups, without a doubt, along the way. But if you don't learn from them, then they were wasted opportunities. Mm. And so I think my number one tip for any, emerging social leader is to embrace those moments, but do everything in your power to take the learnings and then keep pushing yourself, throwing yourself back into the fire, even though it's scary. And put into practice what you've learned.
Hmm. How do you feel about the title CEO now?
See how I was totally dodging your CEO question. It's okay. It's not my favourite job title.
Hmm.
It involves doing a lot of things that aren't necessarily what I feel I was put on this planet to do, if I'm completely honest.
Hmm. Tell me more about that, actually, because I feel like, sometimes we're programmed or conditioned or some whatever, we've adopted this thing that we should aim for this particular role. And maybe you should and maybe you shouldn't. So tell me more about having to do things that you're not on this planet to do.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's be honest. A CEO in a multinational corporation with thousands of employees versus the CEO of a small social enterprise with, a handful of employees is a very different set of skills, right?
Is it?
Is it? I mean, someone once said to me, the difference between the two is that you just have more noughts at the end of your numbers in the spreadsheet. And I thought that was a really fantastic way of demystifying what's involved with, large corporation leadership. But I think that's slightly oversimplifying it. But I'm sure there's a lot of transferable skills. What does a CEO mean to me now? I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's somebody that is willing to always find the creative solution to every challenge and to try and do it with as much grace as possible and as much fairness for those who are involved in whatever that situation is, engaging every stakeholder along the way so that you are collectively all working towards that solution to that problem or that common goal or that mission.
Mm. Were there examples when you were, fighting your own imposter syndrome at the very beginning, were there examples of leaders that you tried to emulate to help you feel more comfortable in the role, either men or women?
That's a difficult question. I always used to look to the good, the bad, and the ugly of every manager I'd ever had. And I had all the shades, and probably slightly more of the, of the bad to draw inspiration from. But there were definitely some great leaders who I'd worked with or been inspired by. And those leaders, men and women, but right now as we're talking, it's the women that I do remember. They had a certain level of poise and grace, even when the shit was hitting the fan and everything felt like it was going belly up. They would have an ability to just be like, okay, this situation is what it is. Like, what are we going to do about it?
Mm.
And they would calmly take everyone through fighting that fire. And I always found that really inspirational, particularly because I am a Mediterranean woman. And so it doesn't take a very big fire for me to explode. So I've learned the art of, keeping those embers, at bay when things get a little exciting in the kitchen.
Mm. let's say in an ideal world with social starters, when, you know, you had all the funding you needed and all the money coming in and, you know, as the person at the top, how much do you think you would pay yourself?
I've always had a number in my head, which is, but then do you know what? Like it gets a bit complicated because you've got tax and dividends and
what you pay yourself is not what you take home, that's for sure.
Based on the amount of work I do and living in London, you know, and owning my own property in Zone 2, I think earning £60,000 a year would be, you know, an unarguable sum. You know, there are times when I've earned that in the past and, you know, it certainly doesn't seem like that scary a figure. But you lose, after £45,000, you lose 40% of it on higher rate tax anyway. So it doesn't actually end up that much more in your pocket, which is why there's always been this big jump, hasn't there, from, you know, 45,000 up to, say, 70 or 80. Absolutely. Yeah. To make it really worth your while.
Yeah.
Which I think is, you know, partly or if not the main reason why there is that huge leap when you go from somebody in like middle executive up into senior, and it just seems like suddenly your salary's doubled.
Yeah. How in the past do you feel that you have done a good job of negotiating for yourself and asking for the money that you're worth?
There are definitely times in the past when I've been very ballsy and said to people, I'm worth this. I worked in sales though, so I knew I'd be making them significantly more. And even then I look back and I was still quite young and naive and probably saying a number that was below what, you know, I should have said. But yeah, it just boils down to confidence, doesn't it? Mm. And also I think with all of these things, like my good advisors and mentors would always say, what's it worth to you? Mm-hmm. And if you walk away happy, then whatever you negotiate, it doesn't really matter. As long as you walk away happy, what's it worth to you? Like what are you willing to get out of bed in the morning to do? And what are you offsetting that against? And in the last number of years, I've preferred to choose to be happy and less stressed. Doesn't say I am. Doesn't mean I am less stressed, but I'd prefer.
You're trying.
I'd like to do less work. I'd like to be more in balance and working on projects I'm really, really passionate about. And I'd happily earn less money to do that. Mm. I could be out there doing a sales role at a big media organization for 120, like some of my former colleagues and friends and peers are. But would I be happy doing that? I don't know. Mm. Hard to say.
I'd like to end on a few quick-ish fire questions. This is our Tilly round. That's what we like to call it. But actually, they can go fast or slow. So no pressure to expand if you don't want to. But if it's there, we can do so. What's one lesson you learned the hard way?
I learned the hard way the importance of, and this might sound a little cheesy or a bit woo-woo, but the importance of radical self-love.
Mm. Tell me more.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I had spent many years probably telling myself the more negative messages. And, you know, I think this is indicative of a lot of people of my generation. We grew up in the 90s, and our influences were not necessarily the most healthy, the things that we were seeing in the media. And when nobody looks like you in the media and you're completely different, then you start to question, do you belong? Where do you fit in? And why does my body look like this? And all of those awkward questions. I just had created a rhetoric, a thought pattern, a set of stories about myself that were not the most wholesome or positive. And it took me a really long time to learn that one. And I learned it the hard way. But it was the best thing that I could have ever done. I think everybody needs to probably learn to unfuck themselves and unravel those negative stories and get them to a place of self-love and self-belief. Because when you do, and I mean, some people are born with those gifts or they're lucky enough to develop them at a younger age, right? But it doesn't matter when you get to that in your life. But it's a journey for everybody is to learn how to love themselves, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting, you talk about the thought patterns, the media pressure, nobody looks like you, the body stuff. I mean, God, the body stuff. Before we realized how pervasive not just Photoshop, but filtering and makeup and, you know, all of those things were. I mean, it's something that's very much on my mind right now because I had to get photos taken. I had to get professional photos taken for the podcast. And I was very fortunate to have two of my friends doing hair and makeup who were very, very patient with me. But it was like, I mean, I'm a fairly confident person, but it felt like I was drawn into my 15-year-old self with every insecurity on display, and somehow if I'm not pretty enough, I must not be a good podcast host in audio format. I mean, it's crazy. And yet you say these beliefs out loud and they sound crazy because they are a bit crazy, but they're still there. So how did you actually learn it, and how can other people learn it? Not the hard way, the easier way, let's say.
Well, there are things you can do. There are literally techniques that you can apply in your daily life that over time start to rewrite those negative patterns. And so I've had therapy. I've been through cognitive behavioral therapy several times. I journal, I write positive affirmations. Mm. There are definitely times when I don't do any of these things and I fall back into bad habits. But every time then I do, I recognize like, okay, it's time to get back onto the, to the mantras and telling myself all the good things about myself and not feeling uncomfortable doing it either, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm like you. I can't even see a picture of myself without freaking out in a number of different ways and then berating myself for doing it because I should be a lot more confident than that.
Yes!
Oh, it's completely messed up. I mean, what happened?
What happened? How did we adopt this belief? I mean, this could be a whole separate podcast, but mm-hmm. how did we adopt this belief that somehow, you weren't worthy of doing anything in this world if you weren't pretty enough or thin enough? You know, I mean, it seems cliche. It feels like it's talked about so much and yet like doesn't feel like we've solved that problem for women and girls.
No.
And I don't know, I can't speak to the male experience. I'm sure they have their own, pathology about this, but certainly I can speak to the female experience.
And is it getting any better now that we have more different shapes and sizes and different looks being represented in big, ad campaigns and across the media? Or has the damage just been done? And is there still a disproportionate amount of weighting that goes to both? So you might have the plus size or the curvier models now appearing on billboards, but there's still so much Instagram perfection, or whatever your idea of, or whatever the media's idea of what perfection is, going on that actually then the scales are still tipped in the wrong way.
Yeah, exactly. So I have this exactly the same question. I mean, let's just take the Instagram and the filtering. Mm. Because actually Instagram filters was one of my main motivations for starting this podcast, because I just thought, our lives are not that pretty. They're not that pretty. And I think it's really alienating and really discouraging to see quote unquote inspirational stories of perfection and not understand and not get a view of at least some of the messy, complicated truth and struggle behind it. And these stories that we tell, whether they're visual or in words, of, I had a struggle, I got over it, and now everything is great. That is not empowering. It's the exact opposite of empowering. Empowering is, I struggled with this, I evolved a little bit, I achieved this, and this is my next struggle that I'm working with now, or the next set of struggles. And this is, again, the messy, complicated truth that I haven't quite figured out for myself. That's what I feel like we need to platform more than just this Instagram perfection.
I'm a big fan of you. This is exactly why I wanted to come on this show, because women are often labeled a certain way if they show those vulnerabilities or if they go a bit crazy for a while, or you've got to be in a box, you've got to be perfect. Yeah. It's okay to say, it seems okay to say, I had that one time where I was a drug addict or an alcoholic or a bulimic, but I'm eradicated of all of those ills
I'm
now.
I'm so much better
now. Cured. And come and watch my YouTube channel. I'll tell you exactly how I did it. Mm. And I'll hopefully get paid along the way, right? And I'll make money out of that. But like real life and challenge and adversity is not that simple. It's a flawed process, and it's one of many steps forward and then many steps back. Yeah. And there's no cookie cutter, one size fits all solution to anything. Mm. I think the sooner we're all just really honest and tell the truth about the human condition.
Yeah. It's as old as time, right? It's as old as time. And
we won't feel like freaks.
Yes, that's exactly it. You know, you're not the only one. That's what I feel like saying that to every girl. I mean, every person. But, you know, again, my relatable experience, like, you're not the only one. In fact, if there's somebody that isn't feeling like this, they're the outlier. Okay, on to the next one. What's an opinion you once held strongly that you've since changed your mind about?
That I was going to get married and have babies by the time I was 30. And I'm now 40 and it hasn't happened. And I don't know if it will, and I don't know if I want it to. And am I okay with that? I don't know. Sometimes I am, and then sometimes I'm not. Mm. It's a fascinating one. And like you said earlier, I could just keep on talking about it.
Yeah.
We could.
What unearned privilege or unfair advantage has been most instrumental to your success?
I am a tall woman. And my unfair advantage might just be that I was tall from the age of 12, which came with it a whole bunch of things. I was really good at netball, so I was always getting picked to be on the netball team. Mm. By way of being slightly closer to the netball net, I could shoot. Mm. So then I learned about competitive advantage and, you know, team sports and winning, which, you know, maybe some parents would tell me is not a really good thing for a child to be getting too embroiled in. But for me, I think I really liked that sense of competitive nature and being on winning teams. And then it builds your confidence. And I think these are all very important things. And it also meant I looked slightly older when I was younger, so I could go out and buy fags and booze.
Yeah, I looked slightly older when I was not tall, but I did look a bit older when I was younger and did have some drinks that I was not entitled to. What's something you think women don't talk enough about?
I don't know if women talk enough about the reality of being in a long-term relationship for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Mm. I think that they are talking about it more and more now, but for many, many years, I think it was seen as this thing that you didn't really discuss. Mm. Or certainly in our parents' generation, they just made do. They put up and shut up and dealt with it. Mm. And I think the sooner we talk about the reality of these partnerships, which everybody, you know, more, I shouldn't say everybody, a lot of people crave. They all want a partnership in some way, shape, or form. And I think we need to talk about it. I'm listening to Esther Perel a lot at the moment.
I love Esther Perel. I'm obsessed with her podcast. Yeah. Yep. She is doing amazing work for the world.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the more we can learn from other people's relationship mistakes, the sooner we can iron out the kinks in our own and make better choices, healthier decisions, choose wisely and differently. And I think there's a lot to be gained from who's living in the future. But this is suddenly sounding like I'm a staunch monogamist and just all about, you know, being in relationship with somebody for the long term. And actually, I don't know where I sit on that. Maybe I don't want to be with someone 40 years. And this is about the fact that we've been fed a vision, an idea, a dream, whatever you want to call it, that's been pumped through films, books, romance, you know, novels, everything. And it's not true. There's no happily ever after. It's just not realistic. And it's messed us all up.
Yes, I really do think it's messed us all up. Yes, absolutely. And I would love to be challenged on that by somebody because I entertain the idea that I could be wrong about it. But I just think that we need a much more nuanced, honest conversation about how messy what loving somebody, you know, is actually. It's not this. And to think about the amount of time and energy I spent obsessing about if I was going to meet somebody, when I was going to meet somebody, if, you know, when I was younger, and now being like, I'm very happy in my relationship. You know, obviously, like, you know, we have family together and that's amazing. But also, I'd be just fine if I wasn't. Mm. And you're not supposed to say that out loud. But I really, you know, but I would be. And
but it's not an option, is it? No. Or certainly for us, it wasn't an option growing up. You were just told you will meet somebody, probably of your same sex, and you will get married and you'll settle down and you'll have babies. On the whole, I think that is the story that we were all fed.
Yeah.
And we all went out into the world believing it.
Yes, right.
And so I speak really for myself here and every other single, you know, single person in my circle. When we say, then we've had to learn how to grieve that story because it hasn't happened necessarily in the order of which it was told to us that it would. And then we've had to relearn how to do life in a completely new way because there weren't role models and there weren't stories being passed down about the alternative to that classical Hollywood or Disney tale.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, as women, I feel, I read a study once, and I don't remember who did it, I shouldn't really be referencing it, but I'm going to, that said that the amount of loneliness you feel as a person is directly correlated to how much time you spend with women. And that is true whether or not you are a woman or a man. And I think there is something about female friendship and female love for people that is powerful and interesting and nourishing. And again, speaking in huge generalities and, you know, we can splice it, I'm sure, different ways. But there's a lot of other ways to have companionship and experience love outside of this heteronormative, monogamous vision we could definitely be talking more about. Have you ever had a Me Too moment?
Again, I want to know what a Me Too moment is in the context of this conversation.
Do you know what? That's maybe even a better question. What is a Me Too moment? Because one of the reasons I ask this question is because I feel like we haven't actually had that conversation. What is a Me Too moment?
Yeah. It's like if we just took a beat and asked what is white privilege, I think that could be quite useful at the moment too. But we're not talking about that. What is a Me Too moment? To me, it's where somebody in a position of power takes advantage of somebody who may be at a slightly different level in their seniority, if this is a work scenario, and abuse is a strong word, or it may well be abuse, right? But takes advantage of that situation for their intimacy gains. Mm. I'm trying to choose my words really carefully here.
Yeah, it's a delicate subject. It's a really delicate subject, and there's and emotions run high around it, and opinions are strong about it. And yet, again, feels like a topic that we have to entertain the messiness and the nuance of it and the fact that it's, you know, different. I mean, I personally have a tension between, and I think I've said this before in this very podcast, actually, it's something I spent a lot of time thinking about, because I have personally a tension between an adult woman has the agency to say yes to sex or, you know, things that are like sex to men who are older and more powerful than her. She has agency as an adult to do that. And I think it does a disservice to women, and it's a bit pejorative to say, you know, oh, you couldn't have possibly known what you were doing. And yet, at the same time, what is also true is that particularly, I mean, a lot of these stories that have come out around, you know, media and what have you, is that people in positions of power can really take advantage of women who are, yes, the legal consenting age and are adults and have agency, but are young and have less power and may not understand the power they have to say no, or may not feel they have that power in that particular situation. Mm. Both of those things are true in my mind. And so I feel like the conversation we're kind of not having is how both of those things can be true and how we need to operate in a world where they are both true.
Yeah, it is such a nuanced environment, and it comes down to codes of ethics, responsibility, maturity, in many cases a clear line between right and wrong.
Mm.
But, you know, I remember when I was in my early 20s, I can imagine how another woman in her early 20s might feel a certain type of way about turning a man down.
100%.
If he was her boss or senior in the organisation, for fear of embarrassing him or making him then retaliate if he seemed that type of person. Mm. Or maybe even just being incredibly flattered by the fact that this, you know, senior figure, maybe a high profile figure in many cases, somebody with status and power and money. It's also quite seductive, isn't it? And
100%.
When you're young and insecure and feeling your way and experimenting and trying new things, maybe you might go into a scenario where there's an offer on the table or you're just being invited to hang out, and you might do all of those things with the best of intentions and having no idea which way it's going to go.
Mm.
And so I think it's very, very difficult for anybody to assess these moments when they're in that space of incredible nuance.
Mm.
Difficult.
Yeah, it's a challenging one. Okay, so if you could go back in time and tell your 20-year-old self anything, what would it be?
I would tell my 20-year-old self to buy a house or an apartment or a flat.
Me too.
Anything.
Or stocks.
Get bricks and mortar. Invest in Apple. I mean, it would have been the year 2000 at that time. So
Apple
the
dot-com
bubble had not yet burst or was about to burst. So, that's an easy one.
Okay. And if I ask you the same question 10 years from now, I say, what would you tell your 40-year-old self, let's say? What do you think that answer will be?
Sort my pension out.
Sort your pension out. I think that's a doable thing. I think that's a doable thing.
Let's hope so.
Okay, last question. What are you really fucking good at, Andrea?
Ooh. I'm really good at spending a lot of time analysing a situation to the point that I will piss everybody off around me. But it's with the intention of understanding that agency of every stakeholder involved in that situation to be able to empathise with people's intent and direction and motivation for the common good of often resolving a tension point, a misunderstanding, so that we can all get to a good place with it.
Andrea, thank you so much for your time today. If people want to learn more about you and the work of Social Starters, where should they go?
We are recruiting a new cohort of professionals to our autumn immersion program. So if you would like to come on our program, learn all about social enterprise and give back and develop your skills and support social enterprise this fall, then come to www.socialstarters.org and all the information should be on there. I'm also on Twitter if you want to follow me at Andrea Gamson.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed chatting with Andrea as much as I did. If you want to hear more women tell it like it is, please subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You should also check out the show notes for more info on Andrea, Social Starters, and to sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an update. If you've got a story and you want to tell it like it is, I'd love to hear from you. Do get in touch with me over at soapbox.work.